first house that we bought. Oh, sorry about that. We can just go ahead and bypass and go to the slide. Our first house that we bought was in Trenton, Michigan. Trenton, Michigan is along the Detroit River. Across the river is Gros Isle, and behind Trenton is a small community called Riverview, and so on. And we bought this house that was built in 1870. So when we owned it, I'm going to backtrack the slide here a little bit. When we owned, oh, something happened. Andy and I were concerned about this happening. There we go. When, sorry about that. We will go back. One more. Right here. Restart. There we go. So when Stephanie and I bought this house, we decided that being 100, it was 143 years old at that time, that we would fix it all up, right? We would do a lot of work on this home, and we found ourselves ripping off 3 and 4 layers of wallpaper and remudding particular walls, re-drywalling different walls. We had to gut a bathroom because we found mold all around the tub. The old cast iron radiators were leaking, and the windows were drafty, and we invited some friends over to help us take off all the wallpaper, and they found more problems underneath the wallpaper, electrical problems, and doors that were out of place, and any number of other things. And so it took us 6 months to actually get into the house. Well, during that time, I had this friend, this older gentleman named Cliff, and he would come over, and we would work for an afternoon or so, remudding particular walls or sanding or fixing electrical problems. And on one of those days, Stephanie went shopping with Everlyn and left Hudson with me. Hudson was about 3, 3 and a half years old at that time. And so she said, all right, you can, he's just going to be in his room playing with some Duplo blocks. And yeah, I'll keep an eye on him, honey. It'll be fine. We're just going to be up there sanding and doing some other work. And so I started doing what we were doing, working on this one wall up the top of the stairs. And about every 5 or 10 minutes, I would check in to see if Hudson was still in his playroom that was gated, you know, and everything. And he, okay, he's still down there. He's playing with his Duplo blocks or stuffed animals and stuff. Seemed happy enough. We'd go back to work. And about half an hour into this, I walked down to that room and found Hudson not there. As three-year-olds do. So I shouted up to Cliff, who was about 79 years old at the time. Hey, Cliff, have you seen Hudson? Is he up there? Nope, don't see Hudson up here. He's not where he's supposed to be. Oh, boy. So Cliff and I started scouring the house, looking under beds, looking behind furniture, looking everywhere, looking in closets and cupboards, and Hudson was nowhere to be found. And my heart starts beating really fast because I haven't told you yet that our house was literally right across the street from the Detroit River. That's a big river, and it moves really fast, and it's deep. And he knew how to get across the street because we had walked down to the park before, and I was really nervous that maybe Hudson had gone near the river, maybe he had fallen in the river. Behind our house on the other side was the downtown Main Street, and so cars are going up and down, and so my mind starts racing, my heart starts beating. Where's Hudson? Where's my son? He's only 3 years old. He could have been kidnapped, he could have been hit by a car. What if he fell in the river? And I'm just in this panic, and Cliff was in a panic too. I was worried he was going to have a coronary on the spot. And so we're just running around the neighborhood now, although Cliff might have been hobbling a little bit at that point, but we're looking everywhere we can go. Where's Hudson? Shouting out Hudson. And then Stephanie pulls in the driveway. She has this big smile on her face. And Everlyn, who's about, oh, not even, she was working for the last 20 minutes. 20 minutes! Anything could have happened. What if he fell in the river? What if he got kidnapped? What if he got hit by a car? And our hearts are beating. Our minds are racing. Where is Hudson? Where is Hudson? Until we found him in our neighbor's garage playing with hammers and screwdrivers, and he had turned on the radio. So we walk in there. Hudson! Hi, Papa. Not a care in the world. We have this consuming sense of urgency. We need to find our son. He's the son we love. With hearts beating, minds racing, where is our son? Found. Finally, you're coming home, Hudson. So glad we found him. When Jesus walked the streets around Jerusalem and Galilee, his heart beat with a passion on the search and rescue mission of God. God, our Father, is a seeking and sending God who sent his Son to save sinners. And his Son walked around seeking and saving the lost, bringing them to the message of the kingdom, the message of what would soon be his cross, to die for the sins of the world. And Jesus' heart beat with a passion, beat with a sense of consuming urgency, because he was doing what the Father had commissioned him to do. And if we call ourselves Jesus' followers, then we are to follow the same path that he went. And yet I often think, where's my consuming sense of urgency like I had with my son? Does my heart beat with the same passion that Jesus' heart beat with when he walked on this earth during his earthly ministry? He came first to the house of Israel, but ultimately he came to seek and to save all who are lost. And that includes not only the Jews, but also the Goyim, the Gentiles. Bring us to saving message of the gospel. And yet, if I'm honest, if you're honest, I wonder sometimes, where's the block? What kind of heart blockage do I have that I don't have that same urgency when it comes to the search and rescue mission of God? If Jesus' heart was beating out of his chest for love for the people that he looked upon with compassion, and he was moved in his inner person, moved with compassion for the lost because they were like sheep without a shepherd, why does my heart not beat like that too if I say I'm a follower of Jesus? Sometimes maybe we're distracted. Sometimes we're over busy. Sometimes maybe we're afraid of what people may say or think or do. What's your heart blockage? What's my heart block? The disciples and the religious leaders, Pharisees and the law experts known as the scribes, they had heart blocks that sidelined them from God's mission. And Jesus brings up two of the major heart blocks. First in Matthew chapter 18, and the coupled together with the same parable in Luke chapter 15. Matthew chapter 18, Luke chapter 15. We're going to see the same parable of the 90 and 9 and the 1 in two different scenes, two different settings. Same story, same short story of Jesus, pointing towards a similar truth. Luke chapter 15, Matthew chapter 18. Turn with me first to the Gospel of Matthew. We're going to see these two heart blocks and then these surgery heart questions. These surgery questions, because I believe that God wants maybe to do heart surgery on me this morning. He was doing it over the week as I was studying these texts about being on God's rescue mission, and I've been praying that maybe in some way you would open up your heart to surgery from God through his holy word and allow God to take the scalpel out and go to work. It might be painful, but we want to have our hearts beat with the same heartbeat of God, right? Right? That's what the mission life is all about. All of us for all of God. So first to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18, starting in verse 1. Here's the setting or the scene first. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? This has been a favorite question of the disciples. It started chapters earlier in Matthew. We see it picked up in Mark chapter 9, and in the Gospel of Luke, we see them ask this question even later on in Matthew chapter 20. They seem to be really preoccupied with who's just hear Peter saying, all right, guys, look it. Not that long ago, we were all in the boat. Jesus called for me. We saw him walking on the water. And I got out of the boat, and I walked in the water, at least for a little bit. I started to sink. But I walked out on the water. I jumped out of the boat. What did you guys do? You were cowering in the corner. I don't want to get out of the water. So I think I'm going to be greatest. And then James and John pipe up. Well, we were with you at the Mount of Transfiguration. We saw Jesus transfigured. That was just a couple scenes before in the Gospel of Matthew. So the disciples start circling around. Who's going to be the greatest? Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus then brings up an illustration on the spot. Child. He's looking in the eyes of a child. Disarms. Dismisses any kind of pride. See, the first heart block is self-focused pride sidelines us from God's rescue mission. Look at verse 2. And he called a child to himself and set him before them. Come here. Come here. Look at, here's a little child. This was Everlyn when she was just a wee tot, by the way. And said, truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it will be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Whoa! Many of you just had children sitting around you before they headed out to children's church. Think about that little child near you. Or Evelyn right here. The illustration of the child in this passage is a child is at the mercy of the adult. But they put their total trust in the mercy of the adult. And if you want to enter into the kingdom, you have to put your total trust in the mercy of God and in his son, Jesus Christ. Self-focused pride. Who's going to be the greatest? They're preoccupied with pride. And a preoccupation with pride leads to power struggles, leads to a pugnacious spirit. It says in Proverbs 13:10 that only by pride comes contention. And this is the constant dispute among the disciples. They're arguing, who's going to be the greatest? Who's going to be at top? Pride and preoccupation with pride, position, power struggle ends up asking, am I at the top? Am I going to get what I deserve? Am I going to get what I think I've earned here? And Jesus clears the table and says, no. Self-focus, pride, and power struggles sideline you from God's rescue mission completely. It's not the way of the kingdom. A child comes in total trust. Surrender. I will trust the mercy of God. And if you don't come like a child, you have no part in the kingdom. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And then he brings another application in. How do you receive such a child? God's heart for children. What Paula just talked about in this discussion of children's ministry here at Mayfair Bible Church, that not only do we come to God with faith of a child, recognizing, here's this kind of key underline, that surgery question of, does your heart reflect the humility of a child, that the greatest in the kingdom is the one who demonstrates total dependence on the ruler, that the greatest in the reign of God, the future reign of God in his rule, is the one who has total dependence on the ruler. So first, do you come with total dependence on God, trusting in the mercy of God, putting your faith into Christ, and then how do you respond to the little ones? That could be first little children, but also new believers. People have not been following the Lord for a long time. Little ones or young ones coming to God in total mercy, saying, I plead for mercy. I have nothing of merit on my own, and so I come to trust in Jesus Christ. how do you treat them? If you cause one of those little ones, a child or a new believer in the faith, to stumble, Jesus has really sharp words for you. Throw a giant piece of rock or stone milled out by a donkey. That's where the historical context goes. Hang it around his neck and throw him into the depths of the sea. That's pretty serious. Self-focused pride sidelines us from God's rescue mission. So the heart question, the surgery question really is, does your heart reflect the heart of a child? When you look into the eyes of a child, sorry, I'm kind of showing off my kids this morning. I apologize. Carson from last fall. There's no room for pride or position there, is there? It's like, none of that matters. See what I'm saying? It doesn't matter at all who's on top. Who gets what? Am I getting my fair share? Suddenly the focus is off self and onto love. Love for the little and the lost. Then Jesus goes on and he talks about this stumbling block, which I'm kind of calling a heart blockage. He says, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come. But woe to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands or two feet and be cast into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be cast into the fiery hell. Jesus is not advocating self-mutilation here. That would have been contra the law of Moses. What he's saying is, if you don't understand what I'm talking about here, there will be eternal consequences. If you're focused on pride, if you just dig in into power struggles and debate about who's going to be the greatest, and are you going to be at top, and do you get your fair share, there are serious, serious consequences here. So do whatever is necessary to have heart surgery. It's called talking about a change of the heart. Literally gouging your eye out. Heart surgery. Does your heart reflect the humility of a child when you come to Jesus and when you respond to others in Jesus? And then he gives them this parable. See that you do not despise one of these little ones. The child, I'm thinking, is still there. collector, who, by the way, Matthew, also named Levi, was a tax collector. If he had, prior to following Jesus, walked through the streets, the people would have been ready to probably throw some rocks at him, throw some sticks at him, or say things about him. Cutting words, slander, because in their view, he had sold his soul to the devils of Rome and money. He'd sold out to the enemy, to their very oppressors. And yet, those are the people who are coming near to Jesus. They want to be close to him. They want to listen to him. Reading an article by somebody involved with New Tribes Missions, and he said, when they go into a foreign culture, when they go on mission, they need to first understand the people before they can teach the people. Jesus is the all-knowing God in the flesh, the God-man, Jesus. He understood what was going on in the heart of every single man and woman, and they were drawn to him, and they wanted to be close to him, and they sensed divine love in him, and they wanted to be near him to listen to what he was saying. And then there's the categorical, the sinners. In the Greek text, the definite article is there on purpose. The sinners means that all kinds of people were lumped into this. So it would have been not only the tax collectors, but the prostitutes, common criminals, thieves, cheats, the abusers, or the abused, physically disabled. See, because all these people, shepherds would have been in that mix too. All kinds of people were categorized as the sinners, and they were not allowed to come near to God in the temple court. It would have been the ceremonially unclean. The ceremonially unclean would have been categorically sinner. You've done something wrong. The adulterer, the abused, all kinds of people did not fit into the mold of the religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees and the law experts. If I make this kind of common to today, it would have been perhaps, you know, people around our community, the homeless. They wanted to come near Jesus and hear everything that he was saying. Or maybe bikes on the bricks, right? Now, some of you probably have really cool bikes and you go down there on mission, right? You know, people maybe, you know, I'm talking about those who maybe a guy that I met on the corner with alcohol on his breath and wild tattoos running up and down his arms and lots of piercings. Those are the kind of people Jesus was magnetic toward. Those people, they wanted to get close to him and listen to them. Or this refugee girl doesn't know where her mom and dad are. Abandoned, abused, and the physically disabled or developmentally disabled. They would have said, well, if you're blind or if you're disabled, it's because if you're a sinner, your parents sinned. Somebody sinned here, so you're a sinner. So we don't want to be near you. We don't want to be close to you, lest you get your uncleanness on us, and then we'll be unclean for a little while, and then we can't go be near God. And then Jesus comes and he walks right into those circles, and he's the God-man, Jesus, there, and he's right in their midst. And what do the self-righteous exclusivists do? They do what self-righteous people always do. They start talking. Right? Can you see this? All these unclean, nasty people all around. So both the Pharisees and the scribes begin to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and he eats with them. Received in the Greek text is this freighted word, this weighted word that means to welcome, even acceptance as a brother or as a sister. It's family language, it's familial language here. He receives them with love from heaven, and then he dines with them, which was another picture of, I love you, I accept you, we're family. Whoa! Are you getting the picture here? If you're uncomfortable with Jesus now, that would have been at tremendous risk. Jesus kind of amplifies the parable here a little bit. He leaves 99 in the open pasture. There's a little bit of risk that some harm could come to them. But because he's on a search and rescue mission to find the one, he's going to leave the other 99. And Jesus is going to explain here that those are those who define themselves as the so-called righteous, because he's on a rescue mission to find the lost. Because the greatest joy of heaven is when lost sinners come home. And the heart surgery question is, does your heart reflect the joy of heaven? The greatest joy of heaven is when lost sinners come home. That's where the parable lands. Look with me. Luke chapter 15, verses 5 and following. When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 so-called righteous persons who need no repentance. John MacArthur says that was pure sarcasm. The Pharisees and the scribes thought themselves to be righteous, yet they were so far away from the heart of God, they were blind. They had never pled for mercy like a little child in simple trust in the omnipotent God. The picture is shocking here, that over the one lost sheep, God throws a party. Calls all his friends around and says, "Let's rejoice. Let's celebrate. Because the greatest joy of heaven is when lost sinners come home." So I ask myself, does my heart reflect the joy of heaven? God's joy should be my joy, right? If God's greatest joy is found in a search and rescue mission, then that should be the same joy for my heart. That should make my heart beat like God's heart beats. Like when we found Hudson there in the garage, playing with hammers and screwdrivers and listening to the radio, we just about fell on the floor. Like, he's alive. He's found. Bring him home. We were a little bit angry, but mostly glad. And we hugged him, and we kissed him on his neck and on his sweet cheeks, and tears streaming down our faces. He's home. And that's the picture of God's heart, his joy. And when lost sinners come home, and our joy should be God's joy, then when a lost sinner comes home to God, we can't wait to give them a hug and kiss them on the neck with tears of joy. Oh, dare we not cause them to stumble by our self-focused pride or self-righteous exclusivism. Self-righteous exclusivism says, I'm going to stay over here. You stay over here because you're not like me. Or I've been following the Lord for 20, 30, or 50, or 70 years, and that makes me better and nearer to God than you. And maybe that's a bunch of malarkey, because you're not near to the heart of God if your heart does not reflect the joy of heaven. Are you hearing me this morning? Are you? I'm stepping on my own toes, because my heart often does not reflect the joy of heaven either. When I just breeze by the hungry, the homeless, the needy, the men, the women, the teenagers, the children who are lost, and God's heart is beating for them. Bring them home. Bring them to the message of the cross. Invite them. You can't, I can't save and rescue anyone, but we find them and we bring them to the message of the cross. Pursue them. Just as Jesus Christ was on a pursuing mission sent by the Father to do that, so Jesus calls us on the same search and rescue mission. There was a terrible accident not that long ago. That vehicle you see down there swerved off the road when an animal crossed the road on the highway way up on the bluffs. This is near Big Sur, California. Beautiful country, but very rugged, water flying up, coming up over the tops of the windows. And so she had kept in her glove box a little window breaking tool, you know, one of those emergency tools you never think you'll have to use. She had one in her glove box, and so she pulled it out and bashed through the window and climbed out. And then she looked up at the cliff, and she looked around, and it was a day like that, cloudy, rainy, misty, nobody's going to see me down here. How am I going to get out of this? And she wandered for days up and down the seashore, could not find a way to get back up on the top. She found out later, she, for the first 3 days, had a brain hemorrhage. She broke multiple ribs. She broke both collarbones. She had lacerations up and down her legs, bleeding profusely. She had severe sunburn on her face, on her arms, on her hands, all over, for the days that she walked up and down the beach. And then one day, a husband and wife who like to go climbing all around these cliffs saw this car down there, and so they decided they'd go check it out. And then they saw her standing there shouting help, as she had done day after day, help, 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 just thinking if there was, she said in her report, if there was just one car that would see me, if there was one person that would see me, then I could go home to my family. If just one person would see me, I could go home to my family. And this couple saw her, and they rushed over to her, and they brought her straight to the hospital, and they loved her. They rescued her. She said something really interesting towards the end of her report on this. She said at the very end, she said, I've experienced something so unique and terrifying that I can't imagine that there isn't a bigger purpose for me in this life. I don't know, guys. Life is incredible. Her name is Angela Hernandez. And I thought about how this couple, who then went back to that scene too and got the license plate off the car, eventually brought her home, how their hearts must have been beating out of their chest. Man, we got to get this girl to the hospital. She's going to die. She's been out here for days. And all around us, we're surrounded by people who are lost, who are hurting, who are broken, who have sin-sick disease, who are scrambling. And some of them are crying out, help. If just one person would see me in my mess, then maybe I could know peace and purpose and joy and life. I don't know what the answer is, but could somebody bring the message? Could somebody rescue me out of this? And then I think about the parable of the 90 and 9 and the 1. That Jesus has called us to be on his search and rescue mission. To pursue the lost and bring them to the message of the cross. There was one guy who really gripped onto this long time ago. As a young man, he lived in things were not perfect as a teenager. As reports that I read about this young man, things often were kind of rough, but as a young adult, he came to faith in Jesus Christ and went to Moody Bible Institute. And he was just filled with this burning desire of evangelistic zeal. I want to reach people for Jesus. I want to pursue the lost and bring them to the message of the cross. And so everywhere he went, he was talking about Jesus, searching, seeking, finding people who needed the love and the message of Jesus Christ and sharing the gospel with them. He became a pastor of a church in Chicagoland, pretty close into the city. It's called Cicero Bible Church. Started a little group called the Fisherman's Club. About 30 men on Saturday mornings every single week would go out and talk to people about Christ, pass out gospel tracts, go to the bus station, go to the train station, go downtown, engage people with the gospel, work at Pacific Garden Mission, feed the hungry, bring clothes to people, and in some way, in any way possible, to bring the gospel message to people. And out of that Fisherman's Club with 30 guys, here's what God did. they report out of the very detailed records the church kept, 533,815 people were engaged in gospel conversation over 35 years. This was reports after the 35-year anniversary of the Fisherman's Club. 533,815 people were engaged in gospel conversation. 140,000 professions of faith in Christ were reported. 17,159,690 gospel tracts were distributed. Does that blow your mind? What was right? People on God's rescue mission. Out of that church that grew to over 1,000 people, 250 people sent into full-time Christian service out of that church. 18 churches were planted, and it was 30 guys on Saturday morning.